Most of this podcast was recorded Thursday, June 13th at 6:30 p.m. Things might have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like Steve Brown will be back from a meeting at NPR in Washington. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and the shrewd politicians, also known as Snollygosters, who figure out ways to spend your tax dollars. I'm Mike Thompson. Steve Brown is off this week, so in his absence, we'll do something different. We will drink beer as we talk politics. This week, we feature the live recording of WOSU's Politics and a Pint. Three or four times a year, we venture out to a local brew pub and we talk politics with you, our loyal listeners. This time, we were at Wolf's Ridge Brewing in downtown Columbus. So, here it is, a Politics and a Pint edition of Snollygoster. Welcome to the latest Politics and a Pint from WOSU Public Media. Thank you all for coming here today. How many of you are, this is your first time? How many, wow, that's great. How many repeat folks, those are our groupies. Thanks very much for coming. Let's get to our panel here. My colleague, Ann Fisher. She is the host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, weekdays, 10 a.m. to noon on 89.7 NPR News. Also, longtime dispatch writer and columnist. She's been in the covering the State House for a long time. So, Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Bureau Chief. Jackie is the Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer. She has covered the State House for many years, first with the Dayton Daily News and then with Cleveland.com, and she's working her way around the state and now for the Cincinnati Inquirer.
Never lived in any of those places.
She lives here in Columbus, and she's the boss now, so she covers the State House and has a few headaches. And Andy Chow, he is our State House correspondent for Ohio Public Radio and Television. You can hear his reports almost every morning, I'm sure, on 89.7 NPR News, and you can see his reports on the State of Ohio, which is on Friday afternoons, I think at 5:30 on WOSU TV. It's right after Cyber Chase, so that's your key to watch the State of Ohio. We said in our promo on the radio, if you heard it, that we would talk about whatever Donald Trump said today. And little did we know that there would be three things in the past 24 hours that we can talk about. The first thing was when he told George Stephanopoulos that he would accept help from a foreign entity in the campaign. It's no big deal. Then this morning, I'm trying to keep up. This morning it was, oh, well, Kellyanne Conway has been recommended to be fired for violating the Hatch Act. She won't be fired. And then this late this afternoon, if you hadn't heard, Sarah Huckabee Sanders has announced she is leaving the White House to go back home to Arkansas. She says three and a half years.
But if you hang around with me, I actually wandered into his office today and we were talking and I said, when is she leaving? Didn't they say she was leaving last fall? Am I the only one around here? Did anyone? Yeah. And he goes, well, I haven't heard a thing.
Yeah. No. So there's the latest for today. I think the biggest one is him. I hate to use this phrase, doubling down on accepting foreign help, which is what got him into trouble in 2016. Although there was no collusion. Jackie, thoughts on the last 24 hours?
I don't really know what to think anymore. that was. I wondered with that if he, I always wondered with what Donald Trump says in tweets, like what he really means when he says it. There was a tweet in the last couple weeks where I think some fact checkers kind of went wild on it, and it was pretty, oh, sorry, can you hear me now? All right. Yes. I got to get closer to the mic. And I'm not sure always, there's this whole thing about should we take him literally, and what does he really mean? And so I struggle with that as a journalist because I read words and I think, well, that's what you really mean is what you put in those words. But as anyone who's seen Donald Trump, heard him speak, his speech pattern is all over the place and it doesn't follow. If you then read the words of what he said, it doesn't make sense in a lot of time, in a lot of instances. So that was my first thought when I saw that. Is I don't know if he understood the magnitude of what he was saying, and then my second thought was, is he toying with everyone here?
Yeah.
I was surprised, or maybe not surprised, but interested to see some of the reaction from our elected officials, because that is a huge no-no. Like, that's something that, you know, officials have been saying for a long time. You know, politicians, like, we don't want that foreign meddling in our elections. It's been proven that Russia, attempted to and was successful in many ways in interfering with the 2016 election. So, you know, this is just another instance of him kind of dipping his toe in that pool and kind of stirring the water up.
And the other problem is, like what Jackie said, is, you know, do you take him at his word or not? Does he really mean what he says? And the problem, especially bringing it back home, when you talk to the pundits here in Ohio, is that they pick and choose. And so when you say, well, he said that, and they say, oh, no, he didn't mean that. What he meant was, and then you say, well, then he didn't mean this. It's like, no, he did mean that. So then they get to bend and pull and flex around whatever they want it to mean in the long run.
They get to spin it any way they want.
But it's like, it makes it harder and harder because when they're spinning something, it's like, I mean, it's just, you said, it's just kind of lies on top of lies. But then the other thing is, I mean, for me, I just always wonder what the impact is politically. And I think we can all agree that it's hard to tell where people are going as far as their support for Donald Trump. A lot of people who have voted for Donald Trump have not changed their opinion. They say, no, I voted for him. I'm going to continue voting for him. At this point, there's no changing their mind. But what does happen is, what's the impact for the other people? So when you see Lindsey Graham responding to what Donald Trump said today, when you see other top Republicans responding to what he said, you do see their approval ratings or their electability go up and down based on some of these more egregious things.
Lindsey Graham was pretty tepid today. I think he said it was not right, or it shouldn't do that, or something like that. It wasn't a full-throated criticism. It was basically, get on the record, this is not right.
As far as full-throated criticism, there's really not much of that from his own party. Right. I mean, I think what the biggest thing that his statement speaks to is just how our politics are today and how divided and sharply divided we are, and how, I don't want to say afraid, but just how rare it is for someone to speak against someone in their own party. And if they do, then it gets put on blast. You know, it's the headline on CNN, and all the cable shows will spend an hour, you know, calling people up to talk about it.
Do we pay too much attention to a man? I mean, everything he does dominates cable TV news. I think NPR does a good job, but I'd say that 35% of morning edition of given hour is about the Trump administration and
policies.
From
if you look at it from a traditional point of view, I'd say yeah. But he is the most powerful man in the world. You know, he's the leader of the free world and all the other euphemisms you want to attach to the office of the presidency of the United States. But we're also in a different time, and things have changed very, very fast as far as how people get their news and how they communicate ideas in the world today. And he is right on top of that. So if you ignore what he tweets on any given day or any given minute at any given time of the night, you do it at your peril, because a lot of people, that's the only thing they're following. And if you don't, I think the issue is how he's so rapid fire in his tweets.
Yeah.
And
it's hard to keep up.
People work full time truth checking.
It's a reality show every week. I mean, look at the example of the threat to impose tariffs on Mexican goods if they didn't strengthen their immigration enforcement. I think most people knew that he was not going to do that.
I didn't know.
You never know.
I didn't know a thing.
I mean, it was his,
would be crazy, but...
Yeah, I mean, auto manufacturers in Ohio, Honda, they take all of their... half of your Accords probably come from Mexico, and the price was going to jump up 25% in October if it was fully implemented, and there was just no... But it was a great reality TV show that lasted until, what, 10 o'clock Friday night? And it, no, we're not going to do it. We got a secret deal.
We have a secret deal, even if the Mexicans say, yeah, there's no secret deal. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a secret deal. Well, no.
To be fair, he did hold up a blank piece of paper.
No, there was writing on it. there was writing on it. That reporter got called on the carpet.
The question I always get, when, especially if from more conservative people, they might approach me and they say, you know, why do you have to cover every single weird thing that the president says? You know, like, he said this once 2 years ago, he's repeating it again. Why do you need to harp on it? Why do you need to keep paying attention to it? And the thing I keep saying is, because we don't want to normalize those types of things. We don't want to just all of a sudden pretend that it's okay to say those things.
And furthermore, I think that the press, the news media, the mainstream media, if you will, has learned a very harsh lesson from 2016 when, just like everybody else, the polls were saying one thing and voters were doing another. And it didn't seem like this could happen, right? I mean, just statistically, it seemed like an alternate reality. And so you don't run around saying that's a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie when it's somebody who's not going to get elected. It's like you have to figure out where you're going to focus your energies. And I don't know about you guys, but now if it's a lie, I call it a lie.
Yeah. Speaking of polls... that was in the news this week, that a lot of the polls are showing the head-to-head matchups between Joe Biden and Donald Trump nationally, which national polls don't really mean anything because you can win the popular vote and not be elected president. The key is the state-by-state polls because of the Electoral College, but even those polls, the Trump administration's, according to the New York Times, their internal polls showed Joe Biden beating Donald Trump in many of these states, including Texas and places like that. We'll see if that happens, but anyway. But so Donald Trump's approval rating right now is at 42%. I think most political consultants would say if you're at 42%, you ought to be making alternative plans after the next election. But his approval rating is higher today than it was the day he was elected president of the United States, when his approval rating was at 38%. Hillary Clinton's was at 41%, so there you go. But it just... polls right now. What do you make of these polls?
I don't trust any polls. I think polling is broken. I don't think it tells us hardly anything. You know, at the Enquirer, we kind of have a general policy that we do not report solely on polls as they come out. We don't write a poll story. We will incorporate polling data into other stories to help inform, you know, something that's going on, if we're writing about a candidate, that we might mention in there where they kind of, you know, rate in some polling. But I, you know, there's a huge problem, I think, especially now with polling bias. And a lot of people in 2016 did not want to tell pollsters that they supported Donald Trump. And so when you saw these polls come out and it showed that, Hillary Clinton was ahead, maybe she was, but I think, you know, the reality was people just weren't being honest in the polling. And, you know, several pollsters, prominent pollsters, Republicans and Democrats, have kind of come out and said similar things, that things are different now, and people are trying different ways to better gauge voter opinion, like online polls, but nothing has really emerged as the next stage in polling. So the way I see polling is it's a temperature gauge at a moment with a lot of limitations.
But he's been consistently in that 40% range. I think he's been up as high as maybe 43, 44. He's got that core 38% that'll always support the president. And then there's that, you know, 3 or 4%. Perhaps it's a margin of error. Perhaps it's just folks who go back and forth.
I think there's a couple of things to consider that, again, if you are a Trump supporter, you likely still are a Trump supporter, and you're probably emboldened to definitely still turn out on election day to go out and vote, whereas I think with Hillary Clinton, the one of her biggest problems is just couldn't get out the vote, that she couldn't get a lot of people to come out to vote for her. So there's there's a whole thing of whoever becomes the Democratic nominee needs to do a better job of actually getting out the vote. And then there's these big swaths of the country, like Appalachian, Ohio, the Mahoning Valley in Ohio, where there's just these people who, you know, just speaking anecdotally, feel like they've been forgotten by both parties. Yep. And so when they do turn on the TV and we see Donald Trump on TV every single day, they feel like that he's speaking to their issues more than any of the Democratic leaders. So it'll be interesting to see what those candidates do on the Democratic side.
And as far as the upticks here and there, 1 percentage point, 2 percentage points, 3 percentage points, I think that, again, you go back to the idea that polling is a snapshot. So if that day, you know, you happen to agree with the policy, because another thing you'll hear a lot of Trump supporters say is, well, I don't like him, but I like his policy. It's kind of love the sinner, hate the sin. It's on the opposite way. It's it's the other way around. So, if the polling hits somebody on a good day where they like the policy that the president has put forth, whatever that might be, tariffs in China, you know, this threat of a tariff with Mexico, blah, blah, whatever it is, then I think that's when you're going to see those little upticks, yeah. Is people saying, well, I like his policies.
Yeah. I mean, the key for the Democrats is not necessarily getting back the working voter, white working class voter, which is important, of course, but if you get better turnout in Philadelphia, you win Pennsylvania. You get better turnout in Detroit, you win Michigan. You get better turnout among Democrats in Milwaukee, you win Wisconsin. So it comes down to enthusiasm for Democrats, which leads me to the 24 candidates running for president on the Democratic side. Breaking news this afternoon, Tim Ryan has made the first debate, congressman from Youngstown. So we're not sure which night, the 26th or the 27th. Those are the two dates coming up in about 2 weeks for the debate. But Joe Biden's got consistently, not to talk about polls again, but when you have a double-digit lead, that tells you something. Consistently 15 points ahead of Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren is next in most. How do you see this race shaping up, Andy?
Oh, man.
Shake your magic eight ball.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Biden has the name recognition, and I think a lot of people look at Biden and they think that he has the best shot of beating Donald Trump, and I think that's alluring to a lot of people. Obviously, Elizabeth Warren has her I Have a Plan for That campaign, yes, where she's put out very specific ideas of how to address climate change, how to address wages and everything like that. You know, if I just wanted to make like a bold prediction, I feel like Pete Buttigieg is just kind of has that cult of personality where just people are drawn to him for whatever reason and can just gain a lot of momentum. If he were to become the nominee, that creates a huge story, like a huge, yep, underdog type of story, somebody who talks about his faith, talks about his military service. And so, well, I don't know. I mean, Kamala Harris has a ton of publicity because she's always front and center during those Senate committee hearings, grilling people for whatever, you know, on any given hearing. So I think those are the, you know, Biden, Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, and Elizabeth Warren. I think those are the ones who are going to make the biggest play at this point. Not to leave out, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. So, Jackie, can defining socialism better help Bernie Sanders win the presidency of the United States?
I don't know that that's his biggest issue, to be honest. You know, when you look at this field, it is diverse. You have senators, you have a former vice president, you have the mayor of a small city in Indiana, you've got some business folks, congressmen. So, I mean, there's kind of a large swath of experience here. And I think, you know, if we learn anything from 2016, it's that experience means nothing. And the voters are...
You know, Obama didn't have a whole lot of experience.
He didn't.
He had a couple years in the Illinois State Legislature, 2 years in the U.S. Senate he spent campaigning.
Yeah. But I think, you know, 2016, you had on the Republican side a field with a lot of the same diversity, business people, governors, former presidential candidates. It just never, and that's not what the voters chose. So I think there's a kind of a wild card feeling to this now, and probably will be until we settle on some sort of new normal. Maybe we never will, as far as, you know, political history goes. But I think the way this usually shakes out is you have a debate, the first debate, and then you have the stories that come out of that first debate. You'll have a couple people get some, like, awesome line, you know, one-liners in that make headlines, and they may get a little bump from that. And that, you know, that's, people ask, well, what's Tim Ryan's path? That's Tim Ryan's path. Yep. He has to say something that really kind of ignites the audience, that is memorable, that is easily to easy to remember the next morning, that lands him in a lot of national press. And from there, then starts to build more donors, more, and that allows him to go outside of just Iowa and New Hampshire where he's been. That's kind of been the traditional track, is you get a bump, you move on, you get money, you kind of move ahead. I'll be really interested to see at what point in this primary that field gets really narrowed down. Yeah. Is it really soon because the money is just not there? Or do you end up with a situation where in Iowa you have 10 or 15 candidates?
You know, I think to say that it's a diverse field is an understatement of the century. It's more than just what we see when it comes to the debates. It's more than what we're going to see when we look at what their titles are and where they serve. I mean, we've got, as you mentioned, granted, a mayor of a hard-hit town in Indiana. We've also got Marianne Williamson, you know, who was a new age kind of a love is love guru type of person, and she's very serious and she's very intelligent. Amy Klobuchar, super smart.
Don't forget Wayne Messam.
Yeah.
Wayne Messam is the mayor of Miramar, Florida.
Right.
Which I think is about the size of Dayton. And he's not even really the mayor.
He's
the mayor, but
the
city is run
city
by the city manager.
Right, right.
So he is the ceremonial mayor.
He's like kind of like the head of the
Why
city
is this
council.
Man running for president of the United States?
This is what I wanted to say was, I would love to be in the rooms where they're deciding to do this. I'd love to know what numbers are they crunching that suggests they could become president of the United States. And
there ain't no numbers that are telling him he's going to be president.
So maybe they're not. Whatever they're doing, what are they crunching?
What do they get out of it? Because if you've got if you've got 84 people who are running for president, you don't even get name recognition if you're the 84th person.
Tim Ryan does get name recognition. Maybe not for president of the United States, Jackie, but Rob Portman is up for re-election in a couple of years, raises his profile, raises some money.
Right.
Is there an ulterior motive to Mr. Messam, to Congressman Ryan, to some of the other folks?
Yeah, and you know that was kind of the chatter when Tim Ryan announced that he was running. You know, some of the chatter in Democratic circles was he's looking to, to raise his profile nationally, maybe land a job in the administration if a Democrat wins. But certainly, you know, Tim Ryan has a track record of always saying he's going to run for higher office and then not doing it. But maybe this is opening the door for that.
He was waiting.
Why not run for the highest office in the land?
It's too bad the one person who decided not to run for president was Sherrod Brown, because that would have been interesting to see.
Well,
it would have been fun to just kind of see how that played out on the with a national audience.
To Ann's point, though, he looked at the numbers and said, if Joe Biden's in, I ain't winning.
He's a traditionalist, and most of these people are not. I mean, they're just not. They're not coming from the traditional place, and they're not going there. And Trump, such as he is, had been weighing in on public policy issues for many, many years, and had been building a reputation as somebody with ideas about public policy. Yep. So he didn't come from nowhere.
People forget that. Every time I would walk the line at a Donald Trump rally, and I'd ask them what brought them here, they would say, I've been a huge Donald Trump fan for years. I've been wanting him to run for president since the 90s. I don't think, you know, that might come to a surprise for a lot of people, but in this crowd, in that line at the Trump rallies, he's been in their... and their psyche for a long time.
He's been very consistent over the years on trade and immigration. He's always been, you know, chirping about the trade deficit and how, you know, China's eating our lunch and Mexico's eating our lunch and everything else. Debates 26th and 27th, I think it's MSNBC. The candidates are going to be, there's 20, it looks like, right now. They've made the minimum threshold.
I think it's 23.
But those who have made the debate is only 20, I think. So there'll be two nights, 10 each, drawn by lottery. So that means there's a good chance, 50-50 probably, that Joe Biden will not debate Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders will not debate Elizabeth Warren. Is that good or bad?
I say it's bad. I mean, I know they're trying to avoid having like a varsity and a JV debate like we saw with the Republicans and even the Democrats. You know, no one watched that little debate with Martin O'Malley and some other folks.
Yeah, I don't know who it was.
So I know they're trying to avoid that, but at the same time, it's like this is the first debate. So,
but I mean, and it depends on what your definition of a debate is, because so you won't really have that head-to-head Biden versus Warren sort of thing anyway. Like Jackie said, it's just a chance to get a good soundbite in, and hoping that you might be the one who's spotlighted on a package during the morning shows. So yeah, I think this doesn't matter as much. I think this. We might see this as, like you were saying, weeding out some of the lower profile people who somebody said, well, I had a good run, I got to be in the debate, and maybe now I drop out. But, you know, again, it goes back to what kind of debate is this really?
For the future debates, I mean, the bar gets raised. Yep. They'll have to be higher in the polls. I think they go from 1% to 2%.
Yes.
But you have a little bit higher of a bar here.
And you have to raise more money.
And you have to raise more, you know, more donors. In that sense, it does seem to be, at least on the outset, a more fair way of incorporating a wider, you know, spectrum of voices than just saying, you know, you're the top five, so you're in.
And is the United States ready to elect, it's Pride Week, it's Pride Month, is the United States ready to elect an openly gay president of the United States?
I think a lot of people in the United States are ready to elect an openly gay president of the United States, and I think it's practically corny now. I mean, I just don't think it's that big of an issue. I really, really don't. And I think that a lot of people who may say to their friends, oh, I'm not going to vote for a gay guy, I think they don't have a problem with it. I don't think it's as big of a deal as people make it.
Will it be harder for him to win than it was for an African-American man named Barack Hussein Obama?
Boy, you know, there are so many factors, Mike, that go into this, something like that. I mean, there's just too many variables now. Everything's the game board has changed. Yeah. It's not the same Scrabble board.
And I think it's not just an openly gay man. It's Pete Buttigieg, an openly gay man. And it's the whole package, and
but
you know
we'll
he's
see,
a
we'll
he's be, a married man. Yeah, okay. He talks about his faith. He's from Indiana. I think maybe it would be a different conversation, unfortunately, in this country if he was, you know, a single man from San Francisco. And he's a veteran. I mean, there's so much to him that he's just not the gay candidate, you know.
But for some, he will be. The gay candidate.
And you know what? Only thinking about this for the last 45 seconds, I'm starting to think about how, you know, a big reason, people will say that a big reason Donald Trump won was because when people who had an issue with Donald Trump were asked whether they should vote for him or not, they thought back to their stance on abortion and the idea of appointing judges. Yep. And that was a huge, you know, swaying point for a lot of people. And I wonder if the Republicans could tap into whatever that was again. They might be able to tap into whatever anti-LGBT feeling there is in that base, and maybe that could sway the election.
All right. Let's move to the State House. The Ohio state government has too much money. The projections are we're going to end the year with an $800 million surplus. It's still a projection, correct? Is that what we're looking at? 765, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Being optimistic. I'm rounding up, you know.
We like to be accurate, Mike.
I know. Yeah, what's $35 million between friends, you know? But anyway, so we have all this money, and we have a legislature now in the midst of the budget. They're cutting taxes, and they're spending money on social programs and on education. And Republicans are still in charge. The tax cuts I see, but the social program spending is interesting.
Well, the social program spending started with Mike DeWine's budget. I mean, he set the tone in his budget plan knowing we're going to have a little bit of extra money, so let's invest that into foster care. Let's invest that into schools that have populations of children that are dealing with the opiate crisis and poverty that need extra support. So he kind of set the tone. The House kind of went along with it. The Senate, I mean, you can't really be against those things, right? Who's against helping kids? It's very hard.
Yeah.
And the increases that we're talking about here are very small on a dollar amount, a level as a portion of a $70 billion budget. We're talking like, you know, $60 million more for indigent defense. That is a drop in the bucket, but it's something that has been underfunded for years and that the counties have been begging the state to pay more for because the costs are just going through the roof. So that's kind of where we started from. I think you also have to think kind of on the long game. 2 years ago, the Republican-led General Assembly slashed about $1 billion out of the budget. So when we say now that we're, you know, going to finish 800, 2 years ago, we got rid of $1 billion. So if you look at 2 years ago, we're still under where we were. So if you're looking, you know, forward, we're not really going to have a ton more. And this is where the Democrats are saying, if you're going to invest in these things, you need to invest more. And now that we can, we should.
Yep. And that's where, did you say local government fund? Because that's another thing,
right,
where the local governments are saying, sure, you're offering some more money, but it pales in comparison to what was cut a couple of years ago. And like Jackie said, when they say that they're doubling the fund for children's services, it's easy to double the fund when you're barely putting any into it in the first place. So Mike DeWine said at his State of the State that it's time to start investing in the state, and it's not time for tax cuts. Now the budget's gone through the House side. It just received a substitute bill in the Senate, and they have added 8%, and 8% across the board tax cut.
For everybody.
And, I'm forgetting the number now, so they're cutting taxes again.
Yeah, the House wanted 6.6% over 2 years. The Senate wants 8%, and they want to. The Senate has rejected. This gets complicated now, but right now, according to state law, if you're not familiar, if you're a sole proprietor or a limited partnership, basically an accountant, a lawyer who's in business for yourself, your first $250,000 of your income, your state income, if it's counted as business income, is tax free. And above $250,000, you get a 40% tax break. Larry Householder and the House leadership nixed that, lowered it to $100,000. The Senate wants it back. So this is $1 billion in the state budget. Arguments about tax fairness, does it create jobs versus are people
it? Everyone agrees it doesn't create jobs. I mean, there may be one job here, you know, here and there might have been a job created, but there's just no question that tax break for sole proprietors does not create jobs. And so that was the fundamental reason why they said they were passing it back when they did. And now they just don't have any excuses now. They're just doing it.
Well, the excuse is they don't want to be seen as raising taxes. So if they get rid of this loophole or they pare it back, that cues up an attack ad that Larry Obhoff raised your taxes. That's the excuse.
And the question is whether their opponents can manufacture an ad that explains very easily to voters what the problem is and how many people this benefited and how many jobs it didn't create. And that's always the challenge.
So the Chamber of Commerce, the Columbus Chamber of Commerce and the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, they've been saying that this needs to stay in place a few more years to really prove if it's going to create jobs or not. Like Ann said, it hasn't. And
It's basically $30,000
right.
tops.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And so what Larry Householder will say, he's the Republican House Speaker, he'll say it's not creating jobs, and then you just have those individuals pocketing that money in the long run. And I think, I mean, you've been hearing this groundswell of even Republicans, especially from more rural areas, who say, why should they support it? They don't have constituents who are taking advantage of this. It's not working for them. So there's even a lot of Republicans who say this isn't worth it.
What's it like, the State House these days? Last time we had one of these, it was in the fall, so we didn't even know who was going to win the governor's race. It's Mike DeWine, obviously. John Kasich is off at CNN. What's
at
it?
Otterbein.
At Otterbein. Yeah. What's it like? What's changed at the State House as far as leadership styles, the relationship with the press, relationship between the legislature and the governor? What's been the biggest change, Jackie?
Well, they're not singing Kumbaya exactly, but they're pretty close.
Yeah.
You know, Mike DeWine came in and it was kind of like a breath of fresh air, just went through the whole State House. You had, lawmakers who were really ready to just start over with a new governor. There was so much bad blood between Kasich and his fellow Republicans by the time he left office that none of the Kasich priorities were even getting accomplished. So, you know, Mike DeWine comes in, he gives this speech to everybody about how it's time to invest in children and you know, public services. And you have, like, Republicans applauding and Democrats are saying, hey, this is great to have, like, a Democrat up there Democrat up there on the governor's governorship. I thought we, you know, elected a Republican.
Except for a few issues,
yeah. Like abortion.
We'll get
to that. So, you know, you just kind of had this different energy and different environment where the governor really wants a working relationship with the legislature. He has bipartisan breakfasts on the regular with lawmakers from both parties. You know, he came right out of the gate asking for a gas tax increase, which is
a big one.
And that is a very difficult sell anywhere, regardless of your partisan politics. And, you know, he worked with Republicans and Democrats on getting a version of that through.
As far as the dynamics go, another interesting thing is as soon as John Kasich was elected, everybody was wondering what he was going to do next. When Mike DeWine was elected, nobody's asking that. Everybody knows, he makes it no secret, he doesn't want to do anything else but be the governor of Ohio. He's not going to run for president. He's not going to run for dog catcher. He wants to be the governor of Ohio. So I think that kind of mentality that he's bringing to policy making has been an interesting switch, because there's not so much positioning of, okay, I got to make sure I do this because then it'll reflect well on me when I run for this. So that's why you see him not really caring what he's for, and he's just kind of firing from the hip for what he actually wants to accomplish.
But
I would just add that, like, he's much more, this is it. So a lot of his decisions, I think, come from that mindset of setting a legacy. And when he talks about investing in these programs, these are things where you're not going to see an instant tangible benefit. But you may, years in the future, see that crime is down, or, you know, students are more successful in school.
Or the opiate crisis is less.
For example, a really big thing of his is early childhood development, working on a child from the minute they're born to when they become three and then school age. He wants to pump a lot of money into helping them develop so that they're ready for school. That's something where you don't see the return on investment. That's a horrible way of talking about kids, but you don't see the return on investment until 10, 15 years later.
Well, one of the things, too, this is just the honeymoon period for sure still, is that he's looking at a legacy and trying to work with an Ohio General Assembly that's term limited, that faces term limits at all times. And there's a constant flushing out, and they care about what they can do that's going to make an impact in 2 years. They don't have to worry about 20 years or 30 years down the road. I think that's where the rub's going to come.
Yeah.
For instance, when he proposed the 18 cents per gallon gas tax, which was wow, he had a very clear reason why he was doing it. And he said, this is the long term, this is a long game. There's stuff this is to make sure our roads are operating well in 20 or 30 years and 50 years down the road. Yeah, you know what? The Ohio state lawmakers, they aren't looking that far down the road. And until we get people on the same lane.
Yeah. Well, no,
I don't know.
Even though Mike DeWine's not looking at higher office, there are plenty of folks in the State House who are looking at higher office.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. So you have an interesting switch that we've seen for a couple of different reasons is that, Jackie, I don't know if you'd agree, but I feel like in the past couple of years, the Senate has been a little more moderate than the House, but then this year, the Senate seems to be a little more conservative than the House. You've got Senate President Larry Obhoff, who we thought maybe running for Congress at some point. I think he's not going to run anymore because I forget the person, but that person's going to stay where he is.
Bob Gibbs. Is
Bob Gibbs, thank you. And then you have Republican House Speaker Larry Householder, the other Larry, who was voted into office. Half of his votes came from Democrats, so he has to appease Democrats.
To be elected House Speaker.
Yeah.
Right.
Speaker
yeah. Sorry.
House, yeah.
To be not his constituents, but to be elected House Speaker, half of his votes came from Democrats. So he's constantly rolling out these priority legislation that also appeases the Democrats. When you see, I mean, even the energy bill that came out, it wasn't widely supported by Democrats, but he was able to get nine or ten votes from Democrats to help get it passed. Had he not gotten any Democratic votes, it wouldn't have passed.
Any doubt that the Republicans are in charge was erased during the heartbeat bill debate and the approval of that into law. This is the law that bans abortion at the detection of a fetal heartbeat, usually as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy before many women know they are pregnant. This is what Mike DeWine promised Jackie during his campaign, so it was no surprise he signed it, but That's not a bipartisan bill.
I think he was hoping to just get that out of the way and let's move on to public policy making, but that isn't what happened.
Right. Yeah, I tend to agree with Anne. This was something that everyone kind of realized was coming. This is the fifth time this bill has been introduced. It almost made it into law at the end of last year, but John Kasich vetoed it, and then they were going to override it, and one person changed their vote. So it was very, very close at the end of last year. I think Democrats realized they weren't going to be able to stop it. I remember early in the year, I was sitting down with some Senate Democrats, and I asked them, like, what is your strategy for fighting this? We know this is going to happen. And one person, who I will not name, said, oh, well, we're just going to do what we always did. Because it's just, it at that point, it had become so routine to have this bill up, to debate it in committee, to have this testimony that was extremely heart-wrenching in many cases, and a lot of it, you know, on this bill especially, but all these abortion bills. I mean, you have dozens of people come to the State House on a weekday in the middle of the day to share their story with lawmakers. So I think there's kind of also this sense of tiredness over it. And, you know, it's on hold right now. It's not supposed to take effect till the summer. It probably won't take effect for years because it will be tied up.
It's been challenged. The ACLU has already challenged it. It's been overturned by lower federal courts in other states, Andy. So this will go to the Supreme Court likely, or something similar will go to the Supreme Court.
And in the meantime, it's put Ohio in the national spotlight again for something that I don't think Ohio wants to be in the national spotlight.
I think Alabama may have trumped us.
That's right, yeah.
You know, it is funny on that because this bill originated in Ohio. This idea was first rolled out in Ohio, you know, the first
time. Nothing is first in Ohio.
No. So and
first
then,
in flight, though, right? First in flight? Except for those license plates down southeast, right?
But I think, bills that passed then in Georgia and Alabama got a lot more of the national media attention, and they were a little bit different than what Ohio passed. Yeah. And especially in Georgia, there was so much backlash from the film industry there, which is very critical to their economy, very important piece there. They were just so outspoken. It just kind of, I think, drove the national coverage that way.
Yeah, the difference, Georgia, correct me if I'm wrong, Georgia is also a heartbeat bill, but the penalties there was 99 years in prison for a doctor who performs an abortion. I don't think Ohio is that bad as far as severe. And Alabama, of course, outlawed all abortions except when the mother's life is in danger. So we want to open it up to you all. So the microphones are there. Just raise your hand if you have a question for us. Reggie will help you out here. He's one of our students. Any questions? All right, let's move on to the energy bill. Hey. Andy is the guy who can make laws of physics and electric transmission interesting.
Who wants to talk about utility regulation?
This is... But it's much more sexy to say this is a bailout for two aging nuclear plants.
And coal plants. And,
yeah, well, mm-hmm. we'll get to that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It
yeah.
started as the Clean Energy Bill. It was designed to both help these two nuclear plants, which do not produce carbon emissions. They produce nuclear waste that you have to store forever, but they don't produce carbon emissions. And also was supposed to help solar, wind, and renewable energy. Well, it got watered down, and it's now the bill formerly known as the Clean Energy Bill because it bails out two coal plants, which do produce emissions. And then there's some solar, and it's getting back in there. And what's the latest on this?
Yeah, there's a huge fight going on. It's now in the Senate. The Senate does not seem to have as much of an appetite for this bill as the House did. The bill which came out of the House is almost like a Frankenstein bill. It took a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It took a little bit of different pieces of legislation that they've been trying to pass for years now, tailored it into one sort of digestible thing that is tailor-made to pass the House, but then is not doing so well in the Senate. Again, this issue, the nuclear subsidies issue, is something that's had a hard time getting out of the Senate for a couple of years now. So they're having hours and hours of testimony. There's all sorts of questions that need to be asked. Why does First Energy Solutions need it? Will this actually help? Are those plants making money on their own right now?
Well, my question is, what happened to that those TV ads with the mom pushing her kid on the swing and the windmills and the solar panels?
What happened to solar and wind? Why did they take those pieces out of it?
One of the weirdest headlines I've ever had to write was the Clean Air Bill gets rid of solar and wind.
Why?
So, well, I mean, because
they needed to pass it.
I think at the beginning it was a veiled threat. I think it was this whole veiled thing. All they wanted to do was bail out nuclear, so they wanted to call it a clean air bill. I think they knew that they were doing nothing for wind and solar. So they said, the chair of the committee said, well, wind and solar didn't want this. They didn't want, there were these credits that they were going to create to help wind and solar, but they were going to get rid of the standards that require investment in wind and solar. And so we said, did they not want it, or would they rather have the standards? Yet, if the standards were to go away, would they want these credits? And he's like, well, no, they don't. They don't want this. So it was all just a way to, in my opinion, it was all a way to just bail out nuclear.
Which some would argue is, if you could do it for 5 years until solar and wind becomes more competitive, you not have emissions for 5 years. There's an argument.
That's part of their argument, yeah. Is that if you close the plants, you know, we don't have the wind and solar capacity in Ohio right now and in the surrounding area that powers our electricity market. So the natural choice to replace that electricity is with natural gas or coal. And, of course, that's why the natural gas industry is very opposed to this bill, because they see an opening for them to, expand their footprint in the market. You know, I have a little bit of a different take than Andy on why they pulled those out, and that's simply to pass the bill. I think, you know, we talked about how Speaker Larry Householder was elected with help of Democrats, and I think he was kind of planning to pass this bill with more Democratic support, and that's where the wind and solar came in. And then I think when he realized that they weren't going to support it, because they made a bunch of demands, they were like, kind of... Republicans called it, the Green New Deal for Ohio?
Really, really wild demands.
A lot of demands. Yeah. And I think at that point, they were just kind of fed up and said, you know what, we don't need the Democrats. Mm-hmm. We can, or not at least a good number of them, we can, you know, then he kind of turned over to the Republicans and said, okay, what can I do to get your support for this bill? And then he shored up enough votes to pass it through. But, okay. You know, the deadline on this is an artificial deadline in that First Energy Solutions is pushing for this because they're facing bankruptcy and they're trying to get a plan to get out of that and appease their creditors, and their first plan was rejected by the bankruptcy court. So if they can come back and say, look, we have this guaranteed state funding for X number of years, that helps them a lot.
TV stations don't want them to meet that deadline because they can still keep running the ads. I saw them last night during the hockey game. Oh. There was a vote no or vote, I forget which way I had to vote. It was either vote no or vote yes on HB6 during the Stanley Cup finals tonight. I see we have someone waiting here. Go ahead, sir.
No. Right up okay. to your mouth.
All right. Okay, well, the way that the Democratic field's lining up at the moment, I haven't really been paying too much attention to it. I figured I'd wait until after the next couple of debates to see who I should really be paying attention to. And I think most people here probably work in the same way. We don't really know what their plans are for electability quite yet because they haven't really done a whole lot of campaigning yet. So my question to you would be, generally speaking, based on your anecdotal evidence, how would you feel a Democratic candidate would be able to beat President Trump? Would they go closer to the center or more towards the left?
Center left.
I don't think that's an answer, Mike, is it?
Well, here's how a Democrat beats Donald Trump. As if it's a presidential re-election is always, always a referendum on the president who's in office. It always is. It was a referendum on Barack Obama. It was a referendum on George W. Bush. It was a referendum on George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton in the between there. If they think this president's doing a good job, they will keep him. Voters will keep him. They're not going to change. It's very hard to beat an incumbent. So the bottom line is it's a referendum on Donald Trump. And as long as the Democrat, frankly, is not Hillary Clinton, because they have a really good chance if his approval rating stays at 40, 42%. That's my take.
I think it's going to come down to a handful of states. And, you know, the states that... just looking into the future in my crystal ball, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan.
Not Ohio.
I don't know that Ohio will.
Yeah,
I think
Ohio.
that's still a question mark for me. I know there's been a lot of think pieces out there, but that's still a question mark for me whether Ohio is still in the game. But I think you need to think about the candidates that are going to win those states and what is the mood in those states. Are they looking for someone who... is going to run really far to the left? Are they looking for someone who is more moderate and can pick up the Trump voters, the swing voters, the current swing voters?
And you remember, except in Ohio and a lot of these states, these kind of battleground states that we're talking about, a lot changed. Not in Ohio. Republicans still control everything. But in a lot of states like Wisconsin, a lot has changed. They have a Democratic governor. He just raised the pride flag yesterday over the state capitol. A lot has changed in Wisconsin. And when you have that kind of, and in other places as well, when you have that kind of gun power behind you, it does change the landscape a lot.
But don't forget, John Kasich was elected in 2010 in between Barack Obama's victory in Ohio in 2008
right.
and 2012. This is not always... Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll give you my best non-answer. Right. I'll give you my best non-answer answer, which is I think the Democrats are wrestling with two things here. They don't want to, they don't want to forget their progressive base. They don't want to forget the progressives out there. So moving to the middle might make those progressives not want to come out and vote for them. But they also don't want to lose out on the blue collar. Liberals, or the Democrats in the Mahoning Valley area, those labor workers who tend to vote Democrat, but not so much on the big progressive social issues. So they're wrestling with those two ideas of trying to get those two groups of people and to be an attractive candidate for both of them.
I have a hard time seeing a candidate claiming to be a Democratic socialist beating Donald Trump. I don't think the country's ready for that yet. I don't know.
I don't think a democratic socialist, which is what I think he would instantly be labeled in all of
yep.
everything, and from Donald Trump's mouth, I don't see those blue-collar Trump voters and the suburban Trump voters, I don't see them ever voting for anyone with the socialist after their name.
I always wonder what could be the thing, like the one thing that's going to make a typical Trump voter say, nope, that's too much. I can't do it now. I can't vote for him. I think we've already passed that threshold where if you're still with him, you're going to continually be with him. I was trying to think of, like, unless... when you said that,
Here's,
I thought...
I
unless
some,
Okay,
got
yep,
I got
for
one,
it.
Okay. And it comes from Jeremy Pelzer, Cleveland.com State House reporter, my former colleague. He went out to... Was it Vinton County? He's not here anymore. Anyway, he went out to Appalachian, Ohio, and asked people this question. What would... get you to not vote for Donald Trump. And one guy told him, if he was in a coffin.
What?
Okay, yeah.
If he was in a coffin.
Well.
No,
here's the thing I think. I think Donald Trump, even though, again, you can't believe what people tell you right now. What they say and what they do can be very, very different, just like we found out in 2016.
I disagree.
But I think he's going to, I don't know if people are going to be enthusiastic about going out to the polls as they were, you know, two and a half years ago. That's what I'm saying.
His 35% will.
His 35% will, yes. But that won't get him elected anymore.
Yeah, but it gets
so
him
I think
35%
around
of the
margins.
Way there.
And the question is, the challenge for the Democrats is get everybody out to the polls. They failed last time. If they don't get people out to the polls, they will not win. I don't think, if he gets every single of those 38% out to the polls that I challenge,
no.
I don't think he will.
I think if the economy takes a huge downturn, that also might be something.
Oh, yeah. As always.
If you talk to, I know I mention this on both shows all the time, but my wife's from Gallipolis, Ohio, so I'm often just walking the streets of Gallia County talking to people about politics.
You live an exciting life there, Andy.
Yeah, they love giant freckled Asian men talking to them. and there's nothing, I mean, they're everybody's a huge, I think there were six people who voted for Bernie Sanders in the last primary, and that was just a couple of my friends, and again, there's none of the big crazy things he tweets or the things he says, none of that bothers them, and they constantly say, hey, as long as my paycheck still shows this, or as long as my 401k is doing this, then I'm fine. And so I think if we do see some sort of huge economic downturn, kind of like what I think Barack Obama did when he ran in 2008, then that might be a big factor.
Question.
You know, I'm thinking the news media, and mostly the mainstream news media, is missing out on a big opportunity to educate voters. Trump continues to control the news cycle by his tweets every morning or his chopper talk when and his sound bites. Nancy Pelosi says the Democrats can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think that they've had a huge amount of legislation passed. And I don't think the Republicans are passing anything, but all we hear is there's just legislative logjam. We, you know, instead of hearing in-depth reporting on the infrastructure issue, we hear about temper tantrums and little tiffs and that.
Well,
so,
yeah.
You know, can't the news media focus on what is actually passing by the Democrats and get into the policy and educate the voters to say that there is legislation being passed and it's being logjammed by a certain person.
Well, isn't this infrastructure week? Or was it last week? There's been like 10 infrastructure weeks. Well, the problem is we still have divided government, so you could pass the laws in the House, but they're going to get stuck in the Senate. They're not going to go anywhere.
So I like to describe the current state of the news media and the way the internet has changed things this way. So in the past, you'd sit down for dinner, and you would have a meal put in front of you with some meat, some potatoes, some broccoli, a roll. You might get a little dessert on the side. That would be your, you know, entertainment, your comics, whatever. But now it's a buffet, and you get to choose what you are interested in and what you want to eat. So if you want to eat all the, you know, rice pudding and cheesecake and that
Jell-O.
Would be the Jell-O, the tweets, you know. That's all there. But I do think there are a lot of reporters on the national level that do a lot of really good work looking at the policy. And you can find them and find their work. And there are people doing that work. And I think where you see the dessert is if you watch, if you turn on the cable TV.
Cable news.
Which I don't have cable news. So I'm starting to feel is maybe a detriment because
no.
I don't.
No.
You're not missing
it's
out
not
on
it.
But I feel like culturally, people turn on cable news to find out what's going on.
You can always
so
go
that's
on
what
to
they're
YouTube
getting.
And check it out.
Oh, I do. And when the llamas were running around, I definitely went online and checked it out. But I just feel like a common complaint I hear is, oh, well, the media is not covering this awful thing that's happening in this other country. And then you go to Google and you search it, and there's 100 articles that day about that very thing. It's just so, I think, easy with the volume that we have today of news and how people consume it to ignore or not see a lot of things that would be important to your life, where in the past you got your newspaper in the morning and they organized everything into
and
a nice
everybody
little package
was looking
for you.
At the same thing.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, the content is there, but the question is it being presented to you? Is it going front and center? So unfortunately, especially with algorithms and the filter bubble that we live in, if we're on Facebook, if we're on Twitter, it's what is cycling up to you might be one thing, but then if you go to like WashingtonPost.com, it won't be the first thing you see, but if you scroll down, there might be a tiny headline with a really great article about what's going on policy-wise. So unfortunately, as far as being presented to you, I can understand that situation,
too. Which to me is another reason why you have to support your local news, your local newspaper, your local news providers. You've got to go, and even if you only use the digital edition, you've got to go to the segment, the version that shows you how it's laid out on the front page, so you can understand how it's curated every day, and you see what really matters, and not what your friends or who you follow on Twitter thinks is important.
But I'll tell you though. So now you know every news organization has a way to see what people are looking at on their website and how long they're spending on there and how they get there. And I'll tell you, most of our web traffic is not from people going to Cincinnati.com to read what we have today, which is the old way of thinking of, oh, I'm going to look at my paper and find out what happened. Most of our traffic is from the search engines and from Facebook. Yeah. So it's a much different way of getting news. And I feel like media literacy is so important now to teach everyone, not just younger people, but everyone, how to find credible sources of information for what you're interested in.
And if your mother-in-law shares a link, don't click on it.
It's the big talk at Gallupolis, though, right?
Yeah, it's a big talk.
Well, NPR does a good job, not to toot our own horn. I mean, this morning, Donald Trump, the big news on all the cable news nets was what he said about accepting foreign influence, which, of course, is a big story. And it was prominent on NPR this morning, but they spent the first 15 minutes talking about the protests in Hong Kong and what's going on there. So bottom line, look for a variety of sources and dig deep to see the stuff. And then share those things with your friends on Facebook, and hopefully it'll get the word out and also support your local news. All right, we're going to wrap it up. I'd like to thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Couple quick shout-outs to Eric and Chuck on the audio board, Hannah and Reggie, our OSU students with the mics, Kate Quickle, Wolf's Ridge Brewing, wonderful host, we've been here before, great beer, great food. We'll do this again soon, probably in the fall, my guess is the fall, but thank you all for coming, great audience, appreciate it.
So that was it. Great event. Politics and a Pint, recorded live at Wolf's Ridge Brewing in downtown Columbus. Thanks to Ann Fisher, Jackie Borchard, Andy Chow, and the great folks who attended and asked such great questions. Look for another Politics and a Pint event soon. It's a lot of fun, and we'd love to see you there. I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.